Welcome to Becoming Church, the podcast where we discuss how the message and movement of Jesus is not just about becoming Christians, but about becoming the church. I'm your host, Kristen Muffler-Young, and my guest today is Molly Stillman, author of If I Don't Laugh, I'll Cry, How Death, Debt, and Comedy Led to a Life of Faith, Farming, and Forgetting What I Came Into This Room For. I do want to let you know that there is a bit of a content warning on this episode, as Molly's book is a memoir about the loss of her mother. We will touch briefly in this episode on miscarriage, depression, and unfortunately, vomit. But it is also a conversation filled with hope, laughter, and how to find joy in the midst of all of it. Like Meg Houston said when she left us a review on Apple Podcasts, if you ever need a lift, you need to listen to this podcast. I've laughed, I've cried, I've learned things I can apply to my life as a mom, as a Christian, and as a human in general. Kristen does such an amazing job of asking the questions that are going to get the best answers, and it is definitely a highlight of my week when a new episode drops. If you ever want to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, we would love for you to do that, as it does help people to find the show. For now, I hope this episode proves all that to be true as you listen to my conversation with Molly Stillman. Molly Stillman, welcome to Becoming Church.
Oh my goodness, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Should we give them a little inside baseball peek behind the curtain this morning?
Please, let's.
What? So you came on basically apologizing. I was like, good morning. And you were like, I'm so sorry.
I was like,
what is life today for you?
What is life today is that I've been up since 3:30 with a sick kid, sick kid who, again, woke up at 3:30 with like the stomach ache. And then you're like, what's going on? And then I got her situated. And then I was going to take her into school late because then she was fine. Like she went from being like, I'm on my deathbed to totally fine. And then my other kid comes downstairs and is like, Mom, I don't feel so good. And I was like, oh, you're probably fine. Like it's probably sympathy. And then violent vomit everywhere. And so
First thing in the morning.
And so I looked at my husband. I was like, well, that kid's staying home. The other one's going to school. Like, I don't know. So I normally like, I have a very like, I'm not like regimented, but like when my kids leave for school, like I have my morning routine, like feeding all the animals. I come inside, I do my Bible, like I get my shower, I put my makeup on, like I get ready for the day, even if I'm not going anywhere, because that's just my routine. And so everything is thrown off. I haven't showered. I threw some mascara on in case this video was going to be shown anywhere on the internet. You know, so it looks like I'm halfway functioning. Also, we learned that Kristen and I both give our children popcorn buckets as barf buckets. And so
yes. Are we the worst or the best moms ever? I'm not sure.
Or maybe this is like a thing that every mom does and they don't, no one talks about it.
Yes. Let us normalize this for you, that the thing you eat popcorn out of can also be the thing that you barf into.
Yes. And you're just like, you know, and my kids are at least at the age where for the most part, like they can make it to the bathroom, but you just, I mean, there's just nothing. I have told my husband this. I'm like, I genuinely in parenting, like vomit is the thing that I just, I cannot deal. I tap out. I go, this is all you. I cannot. Paul. Anyway, so hello, everyone. The Becoming
Hey,
Church
listeners. Podcast listeners. Swallow that coffee down.
I know. It's fine. So anyway, you know what I mean? We've all been there. It's fine.
We have. And our listeners, listen, if they didn't have a rough start to their day today, then they did yesterday or they will tomorrow. Like, yes. We are all just a bunch of normal people trying get through the day. Yes. Listen, let me read to you right off your shirt. You are loved, you are accepted, and you belong here, Molly, okay?
Yes, okay. Exactly, exactly.
Well, we will just jump right into it. I want to ask you two questions right up front. Your website says that your goal is to make people laugh, cry, and laugh till they cry. Mm-hmm. So I want to know, Molly, for you, what's something that made you laugh lately, and what is the last thing that you cried about?
Well, I laugh a lot. Okay. Obviously we just laughed just now.
Yes.
But the first thing I think the first thing that actually comes to mind is my kids just like in general make me laugh, and they will say things that just they're not trying to be funny, but they just are. And my 8-year-old son in particular, the one who is currently on the couch, he is just the kind of kid who says things and it's just, it's so funny. So he'll make these little snide comments that he doesn't, again, mean to be snide, but he will just make a little comment that just crack my husband and I up. And even his teacher loves him so much. And he's like, but it's not like Amos will like talk out of turn, but he'll like make a comment. And then it's just so funny that even my, his teacher is like, I probably shouldn't be laughing, but it's so hilarious, but I can't, I can't help it.
Like good comedic timing.
Yes. So my kids and just in general are really very funny. So I I could probably name like 10 different stories, but that's I can guarantee that that made me really laugh. And then the last thing that made me cry, I also cry very easily, but it's been, you know, I'm coming off of a roller coaster of emotions season in that like, I don't want to sound like Christianese, but like it's been a couple of months, really a couple of years of like when you write a memoir, when you put it out into the world, when you release a book, like it's a, some days you're like, this is great. I love this. And then the next day it's like, why did I do this? This is so hard. And I had a really honest conversation with my husband a couple of weeks ago where I kind of feel... I feel tired and not in like a, in just a way where I feel like I'm not doing anything really well. Like I feel like I'm doing a lot of things okay right now. And I know that that's not really true. But it's hard when you're like, I feel like maybe I'm like, am I failing as a wife right now? Cause I'm like, I'm so tired that I'm slacking on things around the farm that I need to be doing with, or am I failing as a mom right now? Because I just like, I've chaperoned all the field trips this year. I've tried to do all the things. And then my kids are real upset because field day is on Friday. And I was like, guys, I can't do it this year. I can't do field day this year. I've done every other thing and I'm not standing out in the hot sun running a dunk tank this year. Like I just, I had to say no. And then I was like, well, am I letting them down because I'm not running the dunk tank?
Mom guilt,
And so it's like the mom guilt is in, and then I'm like behind on other random stuff. And so it just feels like a lot. And so I had a good cry about it.
Okay, that's good. That's good. I will tell you, my second grader, my youngest, is right now, as we are recording, doing like a performance for the volunteers at the school. And I was like, hey, go. I got an interview at the same time. I can't be there. I'm so sorry. And she got all bummed. So I feel that. But also, let me give you some advice. I might have shared this on the podcast before. I can't remember. But it has given me a lot of freedom. And that is basically just knowing every day going in that you're going to disappoint someone. You're going to disappoint somebody every day. And as long as we kind of rotate through, like as long as it's not my husband every day, as long as it's not my kids every day, as long as it's not myself every day, as long as it's not my boss every day.
Yeah.
Just going in knowing with that mindset of like, I'm going to disappoint somebody today. Helps sometimes, you know?
And I feel like I have a pretty good perspective on it. And, you know, like I said, it was a really good conversation my husband and I had, but it's hard. It's hard when you just,
it is.
And I feel like I've actually done a really good job in the last couple of years of saying no to some things, but then there are just times where it's like, there's just a lot, there's just a lot happening. And I can't really control it. And so, I mean, I'm trying, like part of the conversation was I have not done Sabbath well. I've never been great at Sabbath, but it's been something the Lord's really convicting me on lately where I feel like I'm like, I need to rest, but I don't know what that looks like. And I don't know how practical that is. Cause we also, I mean, you are, you know, you work at a church, like we are part of a church plant. And so we are there every Sunday from 7:30 in the morning until 1 PM. And my husband drives the trailer and we unload and we set up and we tear down every Sunday. And so like Sundays aren't really going to work for Sabbath. And then Saturdays, like we live on a farm. And so Saturdays are tend to be farm days. And so it's just like, I don't know when to rest. I don't know how to rest. And so that's something that going into the summer, I'm like, all right, I've really got to be intentional about this and carve it out and make it a priority like I do other things.
Yeah. Well, I will recommend, but we're going to get into your book, but I will also recommend a book to you that I read recently called Tired of Being Tired by Jess Connolly.
Yes.
And if you don't have that yet, I need you to pick that up because it addresses a lot of seasons and all of that. But but you mentioned it, Molly, you wrote a book called If I Don't Laugh, I'll Cry.
Yes.
And I will say it is the funniest book on death that I think I've ever read.
Wow. Thank you. That actually, that sounds like that's a huge compliment. Thank you.
Okay, good. I was literally doing like a closet. I did it on Audible. I love hearing authors read their own stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially because you sang in it multiple times. I was like, this is so lovely. I'm glad I did Audible. But I was doing a closet organization project. And my husband came in. And he's like, oh, are you listening to this podcast that I love that makes me laugh? And I was like, no, this is about a girl whose mom died. And he was like, okay. I think you might have a problem. But I think that for your personality, like it's easy for you to find humor in pain, mm-hmm. right? But how would somebody listening know? Humor can also be a defense mechanism.
For sure.
How do people know if they're using it as a defense mechanism or if it's healthy?
Great question. And I can speak to this because I have done both ways.
Okay.
So for a long time, humor was primarily a defense mechanism. Mm-hmm. And the reality of it is that it all boils down to, are you actually dealing with the root issues mm-hmm. that you're facing? Mm-hmm. Whereas for a long time, I was not. So I was just suppressing it and I was putting on a fake smile, a fake laugh. I was doing all these things to make everybody seem like I was fine. Yeah. So it's not a super black and white distinction, but the reality of it is are you dealing with what is at the root of your pain? Are you dealing with grief? Are you dealing with the suffering? Are you dealing with the betrayal, the hardship, the whatever, you know, insert hard thing is here?
Yeah.
Are you actually dealing with that? And then are you incorporating laughter and humor and looking at the positive simultaneously? That's a more healthy form. Whereas again, a lot of times, like, so for example, I did not go to counseling for the first mm-hmm. time until I was 33.
Okay.
So my mom died when I was 17.
Wow.
I got a surprise inheritance and blew it all in 2 years by the time I was 23. Mm-hmm. And then became a Christian at 25. And then I lost a pregnancy in the second trimester when I was 33. And I thought that was why I was going to counseling, was to actually finally deal with that. Oh, and I had postpartum depression like prior to that with another child.
Yes.
So finally my husband sat me down and was like, I think you need to talk to somebody. And so I went to counseling and I remember I walked into the counselor's office and I sat down with her and she's, you know, kind of like, tell me your story. And she was like, it seems as though we have a whole lot more to unpack here than just a pregnancy loss. And I was like, oh, is it? Is that fine? So that's when I actually started to like really address what was going on, even though like in some ways I wasn't using humor as a coping mechanism before, but I hadn't dealt with the root thing. So again, it's how do you... Are you using humor and joy and positivity alongside of facing real grief, like allowing yourself to cry, allowing yourself to feel mm-hmm. the hard things, allowing yourself to like deal with whatever is in front of you, whatever season of pain that you are facing? Or are you just going, it's fine, I'm fine, everything's fine, and you're not actually dealing with it? That's the two main distinctions.
Yeah, you're using jokes as a deflection.
Yes.
So nobody really asks deeper questions.
Right. Or, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you said to take it one step further, I think you said in the book, you said, my identity is not found in making people laugh, but in showing them the source of real, true joy. Mm-hmm. And I think it can be really tricky when we try to dissect our identity and our purpose, especially for Christians, especially when it comes to going like, this is a gift, you know, that God has given me. I think humor is a highly spiritual gift.
Yeah.
I think that God has a fantastic sense of humor.
Same.
And so this is something that he's given us, you know, but what does it look like to use that gift without making it your whole identity?
I mean, I think there's man, that's a good question. And I don't know that there's, again, like a black and white answer, but I do think that in general, yeah, but yes, I love that you said that God has a sense of humor, because he absolutely does. I can tell you countless examples. Like if you don't think God has a sense of humor, then you and I are not reading the same Bible.
Yes.
Because there are so many funny stories in the Bible.
We're living in this same world.
Like, I know. Yes. Like there's so many things like, you know, yeah, in creation, there's so many things where I'm like, God had fun with that one. Like, like the axolotl. Have you ever seen an axolotl?
Yes. I did a whole sermon on it with an axolotl as like one of my teaching points.
Yes. Oh my gosh. See, look at
what
us.
What is up with those things?
We are basically the same person, Krista.
They are so we are. Yeah.
I love them. I think they're very cute, but I also like regularly will look at them and be like, what was God doing when he made the axolotl? Yes. Giraffes, zebras. I mean, just fun. And just, I mean, the platypus. I mean, there's just so many things in creation that I'm just like, God had so much fun when he was creating that. And then, of course, like I said, there's countless stories in the Bible where I see God's sense of humor. I mean, he could have done anything, but he chose to make a donkey talk. And so,
that's
like,
the example I was just going to grab. Yeah.
He chose to make a donkey talk. Also, if you ask my children what their favorite story in the Bible is, maybe this is morbid and maybe I should be parenting my kids better. But their favorite story in the Bible is in Judges with King Eglon and Ehud, the judge, where he gets like King Eglon's really fat king and he gets stabbed in the stomach. And then the fat like goes over his sword. And then his servants like think that he's taking a poop. And so like,
because of the sounds he's making. Yes.
Yes. And I'm like, and it's one of those things that like my kids literally think it is the funniest story. And I'm like, am I supposed to be telling them that this is not, that they should be more reverent or something, but it is, it's a funny story and the details in it are so weird. And so again, anyway, I don't feel like it would be included in the Bible if God was not like, this one's a little weird here.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, there's so many countless examples, I feel like, of where we see God's sense of humor. So yes, it is a gift. Like laughter is a gift. There are so many things in life that are such a gift. But then how do we make it not our entire identity? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it is how you, and I think this really can go for any gift that God gives us, whether it is, you know, you're funny, you can sing or play music, or maybe you're great at like administration, or maybe like whatever it is, like you're a whole person. And so that thing doesn't define you, whatever your gift is, like doesn't define you. It's just a part of, a piece of who you are. And so I can speak from my own experience in that, like when you shared that line about, I found that my identity wasn't in making people laugh, but in showing people the source of true joy. A lot of it for me boiled down to, helping to myself to understand the difference between happiness and joy. Whereas happiness, that is this momentary, fleeting feeling. It's not lasting. Mm-hmm. You can be happy in a moment. You can laugh and be happy. But that is not something that sustains you. Whereas joy is a sustaining state of being. As I was sharing before, I experienced a second trimester pregnancy loss. I actually experienced two second trimester pregnancy losses in the course of 6 months in 2018.
Oh my gosh.
And it was like one of the hardest years of my life. So painful. I mean, having to, you know, go to a funeral home twice to have babies cremated. Like I zero stars. Do not recommend any of this. But in that time, during that hard season, I clung to the joy of the Lord. Like I clung to Jesus. I clung to that peace that surpasses all understanding that we read about in Philippians. Like, and I learned more than ever about the sustaining joy of the Lord. And so in a time of my adult life where I just was looking up to the heavens and asking God, why is this happening? Why are you not, you know, doing what I thought you said you were going to do? I mean, like throwing all the questions at him. Yet at the same time, like I had this peace and this joy and this trust in him that I couldn't really explain. And so I think that's because I, at the end of the day, like I found my identity in him and what he has called me to and what he's created me for. And so that was something that I was just really intentional about. And so I think that that's how we make it when we make our identity about us versus when we make our identity about what Christ sees us as. And that's so when we make our identity about who we are as daughters or sons of Jesus, sons of the Father, daughters of the Father, like when we make our identity and then our giftings are just a piece of that rather than making our identities actually about ourselves. And that's anyway, so I don't know if that actually answered your question.
I think you did.
I think it did.
I think so. Yeah. Well, what about people who would say that are skeptical maybe of humor in these hard situations, right? Like who maybe would say that humor is disrespectful, like at the funeral or, you know, your mom's funeral, something like that. What would you say to the skeptics of grief humor maybe?
Yeah. Well, I would answer it in two ways, both a biblical and an actual scientific way. So Proverbs 17:22 says, laughter does the heart good like medicine, whereas a broken spirit dries up the bones. And so that proverb of laughter, and some translations say a joyful spirit does the heart good like medicine, a broken spirit dries up the bones. So like it's laughter's medicine. It really is. But there's actual also scientific evidence to support this. So this is something that I started to actually do some research on, and I will raise my hand right now. And I'm not going to tell you that I know the exact statistics. I am not a scientist, but I have done a lot of reading on this topic. So I myself am not a neuroscientist. I do not claim to be. However, I do claim to have read a lot of books and listened to a lot of podcasts on this topic and read some scientific journals. So here's an example. There was a study that was done in Norway. And what they did was they took a sample size of cancer patients. And they followed this sample size of cancer patients. And I don't remember exactly what their parameters were to how they divided them, but they essentially divided them into two groups. One group was a group of cancer patients who categorized themselves as having a good sense of humor, having a positive attitude, enjoyed watching comedies. Like it was like they did this survey. And so they had this group of cancer patients that, again, sense of humor, like to laugh, positive attitude, watch comedies, things like that. Then they had this other group of cancer patients that categorize themselves as not really having a great sense of humor, not really like into comedies, like kind of negative. And then they different studied personality.
Just personality-wise.
And then they studied these two groups. And on average, the group of cancer patients that had the positive attitude, watched comedies during their treatments, had a good sense of humor. On average, they were living 4 to 6 years longer than the patients that weren't.
It's a long time.
So that was just like one study that was done. But there's all these studies that show like what is actually happening in your body when you have a really good laugh, where your face hurts and your stomach hurts and all of that. Your body is releasing so many positive chemicals that are not only running to your heart. So the joyful heart does good like medicine. It actually literally does. Your blood vessels around your heart are opening up. It's increasing blood flow. So it reduces your risk of cardiovascular disease by a lot. And again, I don't remember the exact percentage, but I mean, you're talking about you're literally making your heart healthier. You are releasing stress hormones. You are people who laugh regularly have much lower rates of anxiety and depression and suicide. And so there's like literally scientific evidence that shows that when you incorporate humor and laughter and joy into your life, that it is actually healing to the body. And so, I mean, think about like when you're around, say you have like a group of 10 people and 9 are positive, but 1 is negative. What happens? Like almost immediately, the other nine people can take on the negativity of the one person. Like negativity seeps into everything. Yeah. And so, I understand that there are skeptics that might be like, maybe that's irreverent, maybe, but like, I've seen it firsthand that it is healing, and laughter and joy has gotten me through some of the hardest times of my life. But again, you still do have to deal with and face the grief and the pain head on, but it can be a both and. It doesn't have to be an either or.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for sharing all that. I think you shared, I think it was in your mom's funeral. You referenced the movie Airplane.
Yes.
Do you remember this story? Okay. So let me tell you a story. At my grandmother's funeral, which was really the first death that I ever experienced. I didn't really, I was close to her. I'm named after her. My daughter is now named after her. Mm. So it was hard, but it was the first time I'd ever experienced loss, like of any kind, really. And we were sitting, I guess, between the visitation and the funeral service. And we were all sitting around quoting Airplane, like quoting lines from the movie Airplane, which is so stupid and silly and just making each other laugh. And at one point I started laughing so hard, I went, "Oh my gosh, you're killing me." And my grandmother is literally laying on the other, and I like froze. I'm 15. I was like, "Oh my gosh, I just said killing me in a funeral home and my grandma is dead and she is late." You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like everybody started laughing and it broke something. Like it broke something in the room. It broke something in our family. All of us then just felt like, hey, we can breathe now. We can, we can be here and we can go into the funeral ceremony and we can celebrate her and like, but we all just like took this collective breath after something that I was afraid I was going to get in trouble for came out of my mouth, you know?
Yeah. I think about this a lot. Maybe this is morbid. I've told, like, I have it in my will. Like, I'm like, you are not allowed to wear black at my funeral. We're not doing it. You're going to wear bright colors and you're going to sing worship songs and you're going to tell funny stories and embarrassing stories. And yes, you can cry, but I also like, I want my funeral to be celebratory and full of joy because that's what my life was. And also like at my, like I want to live to like 100. So let me be clear about that. Yeah. So, hey, Lord, did you hear that? I want to live to like at least 100. But also at that point, like, I'm going to be fine. I'm going to be up in heaven. Jesus and I going to be hanging out. We're going to have the best worship party ever. Uh-huh. I believe that there's going to be Krispy Kreme and Chipotle with no calories. I'm going to have my own Fountain Diet Coke machine in my room in the gold streets of heaven in the house that the Lord has prepared for me. Okay. So I'm going to be good.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. So y'all can celebrate too.
Celebration. Yeah. We had, I talked recently with a girl, Darina, and she lost her husband unexpectedly. And at his funeral, they had three little girls. And so they had bounce houses. Houses at his funeral because she was like, I don't want them to remember this as like the saddest day of their lives. I want them to remember that we celebrated their dad. And I was like, that is the most beautiful, coolest thing I've ever heard.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it so much. Yeah.
Yeah. So a big part of your story, Molly, you talk about ignoring God for a while and like really not liking God for a good portion of your life.
Yeah.
And then you wrote that one day he picked you up on your feet and said, I got you. Mm-hmm. And so for people who aren't sure about God, who definitely don't think they've ever had like, you know, a quote unquote spiritual encounter with him where he's like got them, what could it look like for God to have their back right now, maybe in a way that they're missing?
I will tell you, and again, it's so hard because I wish some of this stuff could be a little bit easier, but that's never the way that God takes us. For me, I can speak to my own experience is that God had to strip away and remove all the things in my life that I thought mattered. Mm-hmm. God had to take it, every bit of thing, like everything that I found comfort in, everything that I found solace in, everything that I thought was bringing me life. And then he had to take it away. Mm-hmm. Because what that did was it took my eyes off of myself. Mm-hmm. And the second I took my eyes off of myself and I gazed them outward and upward, that is when I realized, oh, this isn't actually what I like, this isn't actually about me. Mm-hmm. And that is so countercultural.
Yeah.
Because what our culture says is that when you are in pain and when you're broken, like self-care, self-care, self-care. This is not, I'm not saying, so I feel like I have to add this caveat. I'm not saying to not take care of yourself. I'm not saying to not rest. I'm not, so I talked about this in the beginning. Right. I'm not saying that you shouldn't go into counseling. That's not what I'm saying. Right. But what I am saying is that when you take your focus off of yourself and your problems and everything is me, 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 and why, and instead looking at God and looking at who he is, what he says, what his promises are, like looking around you at, again, the simplest things in creation, gratitude. Mm-hmm. The second that you do that, I'm telling you, it's not a switch flips, but what I can tell you is like that all of a sudden you realize like, oh, Jesus actually told me to take up my cross and follow him.
Yeah.
And not to like make myself the hero of the story or why the world does not revolve around me. Mm-hmm. But our culture and our society are just riddled with that right now. Yeah. And it's just like everything is about us and how can we make ourselves bigger and better. And I'm just like, no, that's garbage.
Yeah.
It's garbage. Yeah. And that's so unhealthy. But the second that I took my eyes off myself and I put them on God and I started putting them on others, like loving God, loving others, like the two greatest commandments, like it really drastically changed my heart. I started that process of like really actually doing the inner spiritual healing.
Well, you're right. It does sound countercultural, especially for the people who feel like they're starved maybe for attention or, you know, there is no one else that like cares about them or cares what they're going through. But I know for me, because you said, you know, put your eyes out and up, right? Mm-hmm. When I put my eyes up on God, that was when I realized that his eyes were actually on me.
Yes.
And so it somehow released my need for mm-hmm. the people in my life that I wish cared more or wish that they showed that they cared more. It released, you know, a lot of the stuff that I was carrying and holding on to of like, why doesn't this matter to you when it matters so much to me? Yeah. Why, you know, all of the whys of other people. Right. I was like, oh, but it does matter to God. Like God does see me and I am important to him. And he, you know, he actually does like the way that he made me and he doesn't think that I'm too much or that I need to change. He actually looks down and is proud of me and he's like, this is so fun and you're so great, you know?
Yes, yes. He's the proudest dad. So
it fulfills that need. Yeah.
He's the proudest dad. When you really begin to see like who God created you to be and see yourself as his just like precious child. Yeah. And I mean, doesn't matter how old you are, like you just want your parents to be proud of you.
Yes.
And I realize that for some people, like that's a really hard, their relationship with their earthly parent is really hard. Yeah. But man, when you see like God's love for you, no matter what, even in the midst of like, if you've made just wildly irresponsible choices, and yet God is just like, I love you.
Yeah.
I love you. Yeah. It's so, so sweet.
Yeah. And he's like, hey, transformation, like keep becoming more like Christ. Let's keep doing the thing. Yes. But not because who you are is bad or wrong or broken. We're just going to keep getting better. I made you like that on purpose. I like your weirdness and all of your quirks and things that other people wish were not there. But let's just keep moving forward. Let's just keep advancing, progressing.
You know? Exactly.
Well, you talked, this is actually a good segue because I want to talk about your family for a minute. You talked a lot about having a complicated relationship with your mom's family. And I want to protect other people's stories. And so definitely, you know, keep whatever details you need to keep. But for people who haven't read the book yet, can you explain a little bit what it was like growing up with, I guess, the kind of extended family that you did?
Yeah. So my mom's side of the family, became estranged. That was it was no fault of ours.
Yeah.
There was just some, I think having the benefit of hindsight over the years. I think there was a lot of unresolved conflict and resentment from after my mom returned home from serving in Vietnam. And then my mom, you know, was an alcoholic and had PTSD. And then she got sober in 1983. And then when my mom got sick with her, so she had a disease that was related to her exposure to Agent Orange while she was in Vietnam. And so she got sick in 1994. And very quickly, there was a narrative that began to circulate around my mom's side of the family, that my mom was faking it, that she was not actually sick, that she was just she was addicted to drugs and all this kind of stuff, which wasn't true. So that's the, let's just call it the 36,000 foot view. There's a lot more to that. So essentially then we were cut off from my mom's side of the family. So my grandfather died in 96, and that he was kind of the last thread that held the family together, because he and my mom were really, really close. Yeah. And so that was 2 years after she got sick. And then once my grandfather died, that was pretty much the last contact that I had with any of my aunts and cousins and my grandmother. And I was, 96, I was 11.
So not really old enough to really understand why.
No, I had no idea.
Turning on you guys.
Yeah. No, I had no idea. And I didn't, my parents, I think in a lot of ways wanted to protect me from what was really going on. And I didn't find out. I mean, I found out some stuff at the time. Some of it was like, I witnessed it firsthand. I witnessed some of the interactions. And I witnessed, some of the things that were said, And then some stuff was said to me, I was a child, so like I had no idea what was going on. And I'd seen even before that, you know, in the 2 years before my grandfather died, like I'd seen things. I was wise enough to be like, something's not right here. There's some iffy stuff happening. Mm-hmm. But it was incredibly painful because, I mean, it was like if anyone has ever dealt with a chronically ill parent or spouse or child, like it just is, it drains everything from you, not just like financially, but, relationally within the family unit. We couldn't like just go out to a restaurant for dinner because it was like, this was the 90s. And so it was like, we couldn't, if the restaurant had a smoking section, right, like that could send my mom to the ER. Or if we went to a movie theater and somebody in front of her was wearing a lot of perfume, like that could literally send my mom to the ER. And so it was like everywhere we went, we had to be super cautious about who we were around. Did my mom have access to her medications and machines? Like, and so it, like, any sense of normalcy in our life was gone. And then the thing that, you know, when you're suffering and when you're in pain and when you're sick, like the thing you want most is your family.
Right.
And then all of a sudden we didn't have that. My dad's family we were so close with, but they were all over the place. Like they were all over the country, so they weren't close. Whereas like my cousins, who I was really, really close to, like they lived a mile from me. And so from seeing my cousins all the time to now I don't see my cousins anymore. And so like, I don't see my aunts and I don't see my grandmother. And so like that was, and then my mom was just devastated. Yeah. It was so painful because it was just so much loss of normalcy, loss of money, loss of relationships, loss of family, loss of what we thought life was going to look like. And it just kind of felt like we were already down, and then it was just like life just kept kicking us. It was really difficult.
But yes, it's that compounded grief and loss even before you lost your mom.
Yeah.
Like you guys were walking loss for a long time.
Yeah, a long time. And then for perspective, like my mom died in 2002. My grandmother died in 2004. I did not learn that my grandmother had died till 2006. So it was almost 2 years later that I learned that my grandmother had died. And I was like, nobody thought it was like, I don't know, maybe we should like let Molly know that, you know what I mean? Like nobody was like,
yeah,
maybe we should give her a call, let her know her grandmother's dead. No, I mean, it was none of that. So that was, yeah, it was just a really, because like when my mom died, I did go see my grandmother. Mm-hmm. And I did, because I felt, it felt wrong to not let my grandmother know that her daughter had died. And I did let, you know, her family know, her aunts and uncles and cousins and sisters, and because that's the right thing to do. And so, yeah, it was really hard. But I tell you, like, I will say, like, God has been really kind to, a lot of forgiveness has happened. There's only one relationship that I've been able to restore, and that's with one of my cousins, which has been really sweet. You know, some of my mom's family, I have let them know that I forgive them. Some it's just been more between me and God. But I tell you, like, the release of that forgiveness has been really sweet. And, mm-hmm. and there actually has not been relational restoration in most cases. And I'm actually like, I'm at peace with that, because I think there's a difference between forgiveness and then reconciliation. And I think sometimes forgiveness is just the one and only step that needs to happen. And then sometimes reconciliation gets to happen, and that's great. But it's not going to happen in every case. And I think
it's not always an option.
It's not always an option.
I think, Molly, I want you to speak a little more to this, because I think whether it's family, friends, church community, I think every single person listening can probably immediately bring to mind somebody who one day just decided they no longer wanted to be part of their life. Mm-hmm. And not to minimize death or loss, which are obviously big, heavy things, but sometimes this is a different kind of weight. This is a different kind of grief, because it's someone actively making the choice to no longer be in your life. And then you may still see them out around town or on social media or, you know, with friends that you have in common, like their name still pops up or their face still pops up. And it's so hard knowing that someone has actively chosen, I no longer care about you the way that I did. What encouragement besides forgiveness, which is hard and a process, I will say, often has to take place more than once. But what encouragement can you give people trying to navigate that kind of relationship?
Oof. Okay. So, time. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say this is because, like, so I've got a couple examples in that. Like, obviously, the example with my mom's family is one that I genuinely, at this point in my life, I feel peace about it. I mean, my mom died 22 years ago almost. You know, the original falling out was in like really like 1995, 96. And I really, in the last probably 5 years, 6 years, feel complete peace about it, have done the work of sending, you know, the forgiveness email or reaching out or whatever, really praying about it. And it's truly like, I have no anger in me. I have no resentment in me. I have no like hard feelings. Genuinely, I'm at a place where if one of them reached out and said they wanted to reconcile, like I would be open to that. Yeah. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But I feel complete peace about it.
Okay. That's great. Yeah.
So there's that, but that has taken decades. Decades. So this is not a quick thing, especially if it is something as close as like a family member or just one of those you know, relationships that is just formative. The other example is one that I am still working through. Okay. And that is, I had a really big friendship breakup in the last 10 years. I will not go into the details. That is another podcast. Yeah. Actually, that's probably more for you and I over lunch. let's just say that. But it was a really, really painful friendship breakup. But she still lives in my town. And I still see her occasionally, you know, not like in close proximity, but she's around. Let's just say, like, she's not completely cut out of my life.
Yeah.
It is really hard. It's really hard because I did all the work in those early days to like really work towards reconciliation and forgiveness. And I wasn't given that same opportunity. And so it was like pretty clear that it was like, there's nothing I can do here. And so it, and I deeply miss her. I deeply miss her. But that one is like, even though it was, I mean, almost, gosh, 7 years ago, yeah. like 7 years ago this time, like it still feels fresh from time to time. It still feels fresh. I still feel the freshness of that pain. And like, it was almost like an atom bomb. Like when there's somebody that is like, you're just so close to that, they're an intimate part of your life. And then you lose that relationship. Like it feels like an atom bomb has gone off and it affects everything. And so, I share that as an example that like, that one is one that I genuinely am. I pray through regularly. And, I protect myself in that if there's a situation or if a conversation comes up where I'm feeling like those, that anger or resentment or any of those hurt feelings like start to bubble up to the surface, I take them immediately to the Lord. Immediately. Yeah. I have one safe person that I get my venting out, and that is my husband. Yeah. But other than that, it is between me and God and me and my husband. And so I share that too as like a, it's a process. It's not going to happen overnight. It's a journey. I do believe in finding a safe person to be able to have those conversations with. I don't believe in gossip. I don't believe in like slander or anything like that. So I, in the safety of my covenant marriage,
yes.
my husband and I can freely speak and I can get it out, and then I can go to the Lord and be like, Lord, But then beyond that, I keep it protected. So whether that's a counselor, whether that is a spouse, I don't believe in I don't think that it is healthy to go about just like having conversations with everybody. That is not the way to go.
Well, and sometimes you need somebody who's removed from that relationship too. Yes. You know, I have a very similar story that I could share with you, and a friend of mine, we both experienced it at the same time. And we realized that for a while we would talk to each other about it, because I was like, well, she's the only other person who gets it. Mm-hmm. Like we were the only one who understood for each other. Mm-hmm. But after a while we realized like, hey, this is not actually healthy for the two of us. And she and I are great friends. But I'm like, it's really, because like if she's in a place where she's healthy about the loss of that relationship, and then I'm not, and I come in with her, then I kind of upset her and bring all the grief back up for her again.
Well, it's like what we were saying earlier about like the one negative,
right?
The nine positive, like the negativity, the gossip, like it is a cancer real quick.
Well, and sometimes you have to get it out, like you said, but yeah, I think it's the safe person maybe needs to be somebody who's not in the weeds of that same relationship or that same 100%. Hurt, so that they can just either listen or speak objectively or,
you know. 100%. Yeah. And so I think that takes wisdom and discernment to figure out who that person is. But I think also just giving yourself the permission to like, if it's a deep wound, a deep relational loss, like it's not going to go away overnight. And so give yourself the gift of time. Yeah. Sometimes we just want it to, like, we live in a microwave culture. Like we just want it to be like right now. And that's just not how it works. Especially when it's a deep relational wound, it's just going to take time, and it's going to take prayer, and it's going to take patience.
Yeah. Well, at your mom's funeral, where a lot of her family members did show up, your dad said, I'm trying to read this, Molly. I have sobbed every time I read this line because it is so beautiful. Your dad said, this isn't about the people who chose not to be part of her life. It's about the people who did. Mm-hmm. And that has wrecked me. It is so beautiful and so gracious and so hopeful. Mm. And so I guess just to the people who are focusing more on the loss, like how can we do this? How can we choose to shift our focus to the people who are in our lives now and the people who do want to show up and be part of it? And maybe even especially the people that feel like, well, I haven't in a way replaced those relationships. Like they're still looking for that. What would you say to them?
Yeah. I'm telling you, my dad, he's going to be 80 in a couple of weeks, and he is just chock full of this kind of life wisdom. And he's really the king of, looking at the positive, focusing on the gratitude. And I've just never really seen him. Like I've seen him angry, I've seen him upset, but he's just the like truly one of the gifts that he, that God gave him, is being able to see the positive, and being able to really turn a negative situation into something that is really beautiful. And so, yeah, I've taken that with me in that, like, you know, because I've thought about that a lot, that like the loss of like, just my mom was just such an incredible person and so fun and funny and full of life and laughter and generous and giving. I mean, I was her daughter. I got to see all of it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there was no, and she just genuinely was, as a woman of integrity and honesty. And there were just, you know, and so it was their loss that they didn't get to be a part of her life. Yeah. And so, and I think about that, like in my own life, about the importance of, you know, I think making friends as an adult is hard.
So hard.
Family relationships as an adult, they're so hard. They're so hard. Relationships are so hard. And I think in the last few years, I've really, really been so grateful to God and his goodness in that, like, he has placed some people in my life in the last, let's call it 3 years, who I'm like, these are the people that I prayed so long and hard for. Mm-hmm. These are the people that, like, I actually heard this on Jamie Ivey's podcast last week, where she said, like, the people that, like, who, it's not where do you go when you're in crisis, but who do you call? And I think about that, like, these are the people who, you know, just really are, they invest in me, I invest in them. It's the definition of iron sharpening iron, in that, like, these are people who, like, one of our own lost her mom a year ago. And, you know, it's a really terrible club to be a part of. But the first people that she texted when she learned were us. And who was at the house while the paramedics were still there? Us. And, like, and each one of us, you know, has had that hard time where it's been like, there's a really great story. I have a purpose to this, about elephants. Do you know what I'm talking about this? Do you know this story? Okay. So female elephants in particular, but I think this is a lesson that male elephants and all people can learn from, but it's specifically female elephants. So when a female elephant is pregnant and giving birth, the pregnant giving birth mom elephant will be in the middle, and the other elephants around her, female elephants, will surround her in a circle and face outwards and protect her from predators when she's vulnerable. But they also do the same thing when one of their own is sick or hurt. Mm-hmm. They put the vulnerable elephant in the middle, and the other elephants surround the hurt elephant again by facing out. And what they start to do is they actually, like, make noise. They kick up dust to ward off anybody who might try to hurt the vulnerable elephant. It's this protective mode that they go into. You can watch videos of this on YouTube. It's just really, really beautiful. And I think what I've learned is, like, finding my elephants. and those are the people that, like, when I invest in their life and then they invest in mine, and it is genuinely a two-way street. And it's the people that you can be yourself with. And when one of you is hurt or injured, the rest of you circle around. And sometimes, like, I'm in the circle, and sometimes you're in the circle, and sometimes it's her in the circle. But we all surround each other, and we really genuinely are protective of each other. And I am saying this also with the understanding that there are a lot of people listening who don't have those people, who are desperately searching for those friends, who feel, I mean, we are in a pandemic, an epidemic of loneliness right now. Yeah. So I say this with all care and compassion. And it is hard, and it takes work and intentionality, but here's how it started.
Prayer.
Yes. So here's how it actually happened for us, is we invited people over for dinner, and I kind of identified some people in our church and in our community. And we just said, hey, like, we don't know you super well. Like, will you come over for dinner? And those dinners turned into hours of conversation, and then them inviting us over. I mean, and it was like a, constant investment, but it doesn't just happen. It doesn't just fall in your lap. Like these relationships that I've been able to formed out of really true like intentionality.
Yeah. It takes work.
It takes work. And that is hard.
Sometimes it's multiple dinners. It's not necessarily going to be the first person that you invite over.
Right.
You guys aren't going to click necessarily. It might be. Right. Yeah, you got to do it a couple times.
Yeah, and then sometimes like we've had people over for dinner that are our friends, but they're not our like inner people. You know what I mean? And you can't have like a million inner people. You have your small close-knit circle, and that is so important. And sometimes that's one person, sometimes it's two or three, sometimes it's four or five, but there's so much value in really like focusing on who are the people that are being intentional and investing in you, and you are investing in them, and focusing on those relationships and not on the ones that just like, you know, the people I'm talking about, the people that the second you are around them, they just drain you. They're energy vampires and they just suck the life right out of you. Yep. And it sounds really terrible to say, but it's just like, sometimes you have to distance yourself from those people and that's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. It's a different level of relationship then.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Molly, since the podcast is called Becoming Church and we are trying to help people to understand that, you know, being a Christian is not just about being a Christian on Sundays for an hour, but being the church out in the world, how can people listening be the church people around them? Maybe using humor, if that's how, or if you have another answer, that's fine. But what can they do today practically?
So I love this because I'm actually in the midst of studying Acts right now. And one of the things I love about the Acts church is, and I actually read this, I highly recommend this book, if you have not read it, but it's called Letters to the Church by Francis Chan.
Okay.
Highly recommend it. Okay. I mean, like I've listened to it on Audible. I have, read it probably two or three times. But one of the things that really convicted me about this book is, and I don't remember what chapter it's in, it might even be really early on, but basically it was like, if you were to strip away everything you know about the current like American church and you were to read the book of Acts and just build a church based on just what you read in the book of Acts, would you recognize what you see today?
Yeah, that's good.
And the reality is like most churches today are nothing like what we see in the book of Acts. Yeah. And so that has really got me thinking about, okay, what does it look like to be an Acts church? Like, what does it look like to, and so I shared that to answer your question in that, like, I think the biggest thing that I really see in the book of Acts is the way that they bear one another's burdens, that no one suffers alone, that they are literally like, everything from like, they're selling all of their possessions and bringing everything to the church. And, and they're taking care, I mean, when like the orphans and the widows, and I mean, I'm going to step on somebody's toes right now. Like I have people that ask like, should I tithe on net or gross? And I'm just like, you're asking the wrong question, because actually in the facts, they're literally selling everything and bringing it to the church.
Yes.
So, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, you're doing the weeds on this.
Yes. And so, I think a lot of it is like, looking like that Acts church about what does it look like when somebody in your church, whether it's in your actual church body or in your community, is hurting. Like, are you showing up with a meal? Are you running errands for them? Are you taking them to doctor's appointments? And I understand this is hard. This takes intentionality. Yeah. It takes time sometimes. And I get it. Like I was sharing at the beginning, like I'm in a wild season where I'm just like, I feel tired and so burned out and all the things. And so sometimes like me showing up for other people right now might not be running them to a doctor's appointment or taking them a meal, even though like we have Grubhub, send them a Grubhub gift card.
Yeah. Yes.
But sometimes it's actually me like typing out a prayer and texting it to them along with some scripture and like actually taking the time to let them know, like, I'm not just telling you I'm praying for you. I'm writing a prayer out for how I'm praying for you right now. And taking moments out of your day to do that. We see that all over Acts about just taking these things to prayer, praying for one another with one another. And so I think sometimes it's going to vary on your level of involvement, whether it is as simple as texting somebody a prayer or as involved as cooking a meal for them and inviting them into your home.
And I think also your level of relationship too. Like, I don't want people to hear, oh, I have to do this for every single person in my church. No, you don't. But are you in a small group? Are you in a study? Are you in, some kind of circle where you show up for the people that you can, right? Not that you have to do it for every single one, but are you doing it for
Well, I think here's a great example. So like, I mean, we're a part of a small church plant. We know we have about 150 people. And so I realize that this is not going to be applicable in all situations, but it might be, I don't know. So we've had, if somebody has had surgery, so like we had somebody in our church who had her gallbladder removed. And so it was like, let's just take the burden of meals off of their plate for the next month and a half. So somebody who's really great at administration, this is their spiritual gift, created a meal train and then sent it out to the church. I had never really had a conversation with her before, but I signed up for a meal and I dropped it off on her front. All I did was I literally just doubled a recipe I was already making for my own family. I dropped it off on her front porch, introduced myself, really had a great conversation. And now like she has come to my house for Thanksgiving. Oh. So this happened a couple years ago and it was like, I didn't really know her, but then we invited her over to Thanksgiving because she's single and she lives alone. And so it was like,
that's great.
Those types of things, like that is what it looks like to actually like be the church and all of us are sharing in, the burden or really the gift of being able to care for somebody who just needs it.
That's awesome. I love that. That's so beautiful, Molly. Well, thank you so much for being here. You made us laugh. You've made us cry, all of your life's goals. We will link up the book and your Instagram and all of that in the show notes below. Thank you so much.
This was such a gift. Thank you so much for having me, Kristen.
Molly and I gave you a lot of information to keep up with in this conversation. So scroll down to the show notes or head over to becomingchurch.tv to find all of the things that we referenced. You will find my message on using an axolotl, those ugly little lizards, as a sermon illustration, as well as the other books I mentioned on grief and rest. I'll also link up some other resources that I think may be helpful as you dig further into grief, loss, and how to come through healthily on the other side. Until next time, keep becoming church to the people around you.